Welcome to The Daily Stoic, where each day we read a short passage designed to help you cultivate the strength, insight, wisdom necessary for living the good life. Each one of these passages is based on the 2,000-year-old philosophy that has guided some of history's greatest men and women. For more, you can visit us at dailystoic.com.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I recorded this episode a little while ago. I was actually just coming back from a protest in Bastrop County, where my office is, and they were trying to get a set of Confederate monuments taken down, which we've done some episodes and some talking about. Interestingly enough, my guest today had herself just left one. So we didn't talk about that in the episode. We talked about it a little bit in the run-up. Good news on both counts. The statue of John C. Calhoun in South Carolina in Charleston came down, which my guest, Kate Fagan, was there for. And the statues in Bastrop County are being moved as well. Judge Paul Pappy, who is the county judge, sort of like the mayor of the county out in Bastrop, put together what I thought was a pretty brave and powerful statement about it. It was interesting to see democracy at work. You know, again, this idea that the Stoics are passive, that they don't try to actively change things, I think is quite wrong. And it's always encouraging and exciting to see the process work. And one of the interesting things, there was some talk about making the Confederate monuments, which say, lest we forget on them, put up to a referendum, like put on the ballot. And I thought that the judge made an interesting decision. He found that originally the city council over 100 years ago had made the decision to put the statue up. And he said it was only right that the council own the decision to take them down rather than putting it to a vote. And so I thought that was great. My guest today, Kate Fagan, is awesome. Her book, What Made Maddie Run, is one of my absolute all-time favorites. I just posted on Instagram some of my favorite pages from that book. It's a book I've recommended to so many different coaches and parents. It's a sad, heartbreaking book, but at the same time, I think a really important, urgent book. Kate is a former writer for ESPN, a sports reporter and commentator. She's awesome. She was previously on the 76ers beat for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She was a great basketball player in college. She played at the University of Colorado at Boulder. She played in the National Women's Basketball League after that.
great basketball player. I think even better writer, interesting person. I read her book randomly. I don't remember how I heard about it, but it was just one of the best books that I'd read. And then I happened to bump into her at Summit last year in Los Angeles, or it might have been the year before. I've lost all sense of space and time. I don't know if you guys have as well. But this episode is great. We end up talking about what it's like to leave a place like ESPN, why someone would leave such a prestigious job. And I think her sort of logic is really interesting and inspiring. We talk about depression. We talk about social media. We talk about the power of sports. We talk about what it means to be so dedicated to a craft or an idea. It's a great interview. I'm a big fan. Check out her stuff and hope you enjoy. I was just reading this biography of Lou Gehrig, and it's a really old one. And I was thinking of your book, What Made Maddie Run, because there's this line in the book, and it was saying sort of what we admire in athletes is their ability to sort of suffer quietly. And there's a Bill Bradley quote, like, you know, there's no great athlete that doesn't know what pain is. And what I think so interesting about your book, and then some of the stuff that Kevin Love has gotten attention for, is like, what is this balance between the sort of the stoic, quiet endurance of pain that we demand of athletes and that the sport demands, and then this sort of rising awareness that suffering in silence is not a virtue, and that you have to take care of yourself.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think the suffering in silence piece that permeates sports historically has been in reference to the physical suffering that it takes to become great as an athlete, and
sure,
that seems to be so much how we think of what athletes endure and how to become one of the best of all time. But what does also happen in the sports world, and what so much of Maddie's story was about, was how that culture of suffering in silence, or just the physical suffering that it takes to be great, has so often also meant that the mental suffering and the emotional suffering that sometimes is related to your sport, sometimes is tangentially related to your sport, that becomes the culture of sports as well. Is, okay, if I'm supposed to be able to endure these, you know, 10, 400 meter sprints in practice and not complain about it, then also what's happening inside my brain and my heart also aren't things that I can talk about without being weak. And I think that's what I was trying so much to explore in Maddie.
It's a strange tension, and it weirdly kind of seems like it intersects a little bit even with some of the let's call them sort of bridge issues between mental health and physical health, like concussions. I forget, was it last season or season before, there was some player who got hit in the head and didn't immediately go into the concussion protocol. And then the coach got really upset when he found out. This is in the NFL, but I'm forgetting the example. But the point being that this was actually a selfish thing that the player did by not taking care of him or herself, because not only does it endanger their long-term prospects, but it hurts the team too to not take care of yourself.
Yeah, and that is what has been so interesting about reporting Maddie's story and then talking to so many, in this case, student athletes, but also professional athletes while working at ESPN, was this idea that for too long, speaking openly about what's happening emotionally and mentally with who you are, you know, and maybe not fully related to you as an athlete, but you being showing up as an athlete, maybe having other struggles, for too long, it's been seen that if you speak openly about that, it drags everyone else down, right? It drags the team down, that the coach then has to deal with this separate side issue that will affect the overall performance of the team, because you're diverting attention away from the things that quote unquote matter, whether it be the drills or the overall cohesion, and that you're taking away from that. And I certainly don't think that's gone in any respect, as you can see from the story you just illustrated, and probably hundreds more that go unreported, where just the culture of existing inside sports tells us, like, the simple equation of, like, not being weak, showing up every day, even when you're injured, feeling that if you miss time away, that's a subtraction from your team, instead of this pursuit of the overall wellness and wholeness of every athlete that will ultimately lead to probably better performance, both individually and as a team. But that at times along the way to that bettering feels like it's drawing away. And that's all part of the culture of sports that has been, you know, in existence since sports began. And we're just starting to see, like you mentioned, like Kevin Love and Michael Phelps and certain other people realize that when they became the best version of themselves, it wasn't when they were performing best physically and not talking about the quote unquote detrimental parts of what was going on with them, but it was actually when they were talking about those parts and they were addressing those parts and they were taking more rest and they were taking more days to rest their mind and body where they became the better all around athlete.
Yeah, it's interesting, obviously, because you'll see that word sort of stoic appear in sports. And I have to talk about this a lot with people, that there's a big difference between sort of lowercase stoicism and uppercase stoicism. So, you know, that I think that word lowercase, that lowercase stoicism is a problem culturally, because it sort of means in English the sort of, you know, the unflinching, uncomplaining, sort of endless endurance of pain. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that helps anyone in anything. Like, how many athletes have hurt themselves physically playing through pain as well? Like, we say just like push through it, when really, like, you wouldn't keep driving your car with a check engine light or with a, you know, an obviously flat tire with smoke coming out of the engine, because you know you're going to do serious damage to mm-hmm. it. So it's weird that both athletically and then I think in regular life, people would just, like, they're like, my heart hurts, you know, like, my soul hurts, I hate this, I feel empty, I feel sad, I miss this person. But, and we'll just, like, we'll ignore that warning sign just forever and ever, because we think it's helping, but it's hurting us and hurting other people around us.
Yeah. And so this lowercase stoicism, I think, is extremely prevalent, especially in college sports. And you see it at high performing high school sports, but college sports was really eye-opening to me in covering them and talking to so many athletes, both who had reached, let's say, the NBA or the NFL. The lowercase stoicism that exists in college sports is that there are days off that are mandated by the NCAA, but no coach, very few coaches would ever give you any more time than they're absolutely, like, by law, sure, supposed to give you. And this just, it goes in the face of all science about the way the human body works. Almost every professional athlete I would end up chatting with at ESPN, who was in the NFL, the NBA, or the WNBA, we'd get around to this topic of how when they got to the professional level, they thought that it would be a gear higher in terms of training and pressure on them emotionally, mentally, and physically than college. And what they actually found out was that there was a lot of release valves at the professional level, because people were really following the science, you know, that you might need 2 full days off a week, that one of those, you know, another day should be spent in yoga or in some kind of cross training that wasn't as intense. Whereas at the college level, that what you're calling that lowercase stoicism, it was like this obsessive quality that coaches had, where they couldn't look at the science, because they just had this thing inside of them that said, you know, when I'm resting, my opponent's working. And, sure, and a lot of that is almost like a generational trauma that had been handed down, where you have so many college coaches who had they themselves been college athletes and had gone through some sort of like traumatic experience with coaches, right? Where they're doing levels of workout without rest that are so exhausting mentally, physically, and emotionally, but they survived it. And then they figure the next generation should be put forth under that same pressure system. And all of that kind of led, you know, now this is back to Maddie, it leads to this breaking down mentally, emotionally, and physically of so many college athletes that you don't see on the professional level as much, because the science and the thought are there. And at the college level, there's a lot of places where there's still that, when I'm resting, my opponent's working mentality.
Yeah, I'd be curious what you think of this, because I've asked a couple coaches this over the years, especially at the college level, because you're right, they work these sort of grinding, almost like they work hours that would make people on Wall Street think, you know, are too hard, right? Mm-hmm. And they work these crazy hours. And as someone with sort of workaholic tendencies myself, I was sort of like, if somehow like a coaches association or if the NCAA was like, actually began to mandate coaching hours too. Like a coach mm-hmm. could only work from 9 to 5, you know, and you couldn't get to the office at 3 a.m. You couldn't demand your assistants get to the office at 3 a.m. You couldn't go directly from your game in Texas back to Alabama and, you know, on a red eye, then you're popping up to the facility, you know, before you even go home and shower. I was like, if it was mandated shorter hours, would the product on the field be visibly different at all? And I'm curious, do you think it would be, or is this all almost like a weird status competition to show that we're doing more?
Yeah, I don't think that to the naked eye of a sports fan that you would see a different product on the field, right? I mean, I think you'd have more rested athletes, which would probably lead to like maybe 15% better performance. And I'm just arbitrarily pulling sure. numbers, but I don't know that you would be able to see as like a casual fan an improved performance, but I think what the impact would be a much better experience for everybody involved in college right. sports, because there's just so many different cycles within college sports where not just the generational trauma where so many coaches have been through these rigorous programs and then they create programs where kids get churned out of them as well, but so many coaches, and you've talked to so many of them on this podcast, their daily performance of their identity and their justification for taking up space in the world is how hard they work. And all of that is just constantly fueling itself, right? Because you see that their identity for so many of them is the sport. And so that leads them to project onto these young athletes who are stepping onto their college campus, who might have different ideas of what being a college athlete looks like because they haven't been in it yet. All of a sudden there's a projection onto these kids that this should be something that they're thinking and breathing every single minute of the day, because that's how coaches are incentivized to behave, both, you know, culturally and monetarily within this system. And, you know, sports is, it's, as I learned reporting this book and living a life in the sports world, like there's a lot of things in the world that you can do where your identity can get wrapped up into it. But sports is a particularly like interesting one, because so many of our kids are exposed to it probably more than you might say, like picking up a violin or other avenues of, you know, young kids like taking on like new extracurricular activities. Like sports is one that most people touch at some point.
Sure.
And yet there's very little in our society that I think is rewarded as much as sports are when you're a young person. Like if you're good at sports when you're 9, 10, 11, like the feedback that you get about that is astronomical. And what I started to realize as I started talking to more college kids, as we would talk, you know, college student athletes, as we would talk through this, is like, unlike, let's say if you were great at this, like great at the violin, there is way more feedback coming to you if you're great at basketball when you're 12 than if you're great at the violin, in terms of like all encompassing community feedback, right? Your parents yeah. think it's great. Your peers think it's great. And I think it leads to this place where a lot of kids don't have to address whether they even love the sport or why they're doing the sport, because they're just so wrapped up in how the feedback that they get. And I think you see that in sports as kids go upward through, where the challenges and the pressures of it get greater. And there's no really room for them to actually understand if they love it or it's something that they truly care about, because they're so attached to the feedback loop. And I think coaches have that as well. And there's not a lot of comparisons in our culture where there's like that amount of social capital and feedback loop like there is in sports.
I was talking to Martellus Bennett actually not long ago, and he was like, obviously I got really good at playing football, but he's like, how now he's into drawing and art, and he has mm-hmm. this sort of creative agency, and he's done these really cool books. And he was like, how good would I be at drawing if I had been forced through a system that made my entire life about drawing? Mm-hmm. And you know what I mean? Like if yeah. you had world-class experts pressuring you and putting you in testing and mentors, and there was the example.
So it is weird. Yeah, it's like we have this sort of like almost Spartan-esque system to create the absolute best at something. And, you know, we're not trying to pump out the best astronauts. We're not trying to pump out the best anything that would be sort of more, let's call it, redeeming to society or solve our biggest problems. The entire system is about creating sort of lopsidedly good athletes.
Yeah. And the other thing that comes with that system, for the most part, is the disbelief from outsiders that kids and then young athletes and then athletes as they grow older could do anything but love the thing they're doing.
Sure.
Because I think a lot of just fans of sports see it as a game and fun and a pastime. And especially because of all of our cultural, like, movies, TV shows, it's like, if you're an athlete, you're the big man on campus. Like, everything's, if you're a college athlete, then you're on scholarship and everything's, your books are free and everything's free and you're playing in front of packed stadiums. And so you have the conundrum of being a young person who might have found their way into this very rigorous system of like creating great athletes. And if you don't love it, or if it's stressing you out, or if there are times when you're like, is this even where I want to be? It's hard to even start that conversation, because from the outsider's perspective, it's like you have the greatest job in the world, right? Like, how lucky are you to be someone who is good at these things and gets all this social feedback? And so it leaves young people, when they might be in high school or in college and they're starting to grapple with whether they love this thing that they're doing, there's not a lot of like release valves to have these conversations, because not a lot of people understand what it's like to be in that machine.
Well, and that's where it's sort of the race and class issue comes in, I guess, where it's like, so in Martellus's case, you know, excellence on sports, that was the only avenue he was given to pursue excellence. Mm-hmm. Whereas like when I knew and had examples, although I didn't know any writers, I knew people who were sort of top of whatever they did in different fields. And so I think it becomes even harder where it's like, wait, you're going to walk away from being an elite, you know, college football player or basketball player or cross country runner to do what? That takes so much courage as a 17-year-old to be like, I don't know, I'm going to figure it out. Who could do that?
Right. And especially, you know, with the identity wrapped up in it. Like, I don't care how, you know, perhaps there's some 17-year-olds out there who have that kind of self-awareness to understand they can't let their identity get wrapped up in their sport. But like, I've been on like 30 college campuses, Division I campuses, talking to athletic departments. I've met a handful of those kids who have their identity in something that is within their control, where sports is not fully in your control the way we think of it. Like, your performance and all of that, a lot of times it gets out of your control. And so these kids, just the ability to think, all right, what could my identity be outside of that? Like, their brains aren't working that way until much later.
No, it's like very, very few of us are Pat Tillman, right? That can go like, here's who I am. This is what I want to do. This is what I'm going to do next. I don't care if you like me, hate me, whatever. You know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting in your book, it's something that stuck with me that I think I sort of accidentally lucked into, but is sort of more underrated as a strategy for parents with kids going to college, is you talk about this seminal moment in her life, and I'm forgetting what the two schools were, but where she's basically deciding between one school and then one slightly less competitive school. And you sort of speculate on how differently things might have turned out had she gone to the place where she was, you know, maybe she fit in a little bit more, maybe it was a little less centered around sports. You know, maybe she would have had the freedom to, you know, get help or to balance out her life with other things. And so this idea of like, you know, not everyone has to go to Harvard, you know, not everyone has to get in, just because it's the most competitive or best place doesn't mean that it's the right place for you.
Yeah. And that's a strategy that I see very few young people employing, the strategy of like, what's best for me versus what will give me the most validation within society. It's hard to distinguish when you're a young person. It's hard to choose the one that you think is best suited for you versus what will get you the most cachet. Like, that's a tough equation when you're a kid and you're growing up. And in Maddie's case, it was do I go to Lehigh and play soccer, or do I go to an Ivy League school and I run? You know, and in both, in one case, it was, do I go to a school that maybe isn't as prestigious as an Ivy League, although a fantastic school in its own right, and play a sport I love? Or do I play a sport, do I run, which is not a sport that I'm in love with, in order to get this huge chunk of social capital? And that to me was one variable in her story, was doing this extremely grueling solo sport in order to earn social capital versus doing something she loved, but, you know, go to school that might not impress people as much. And like in the sports world, I just don't see, and probably across the board, just the way we're raising our kids in like achievement culture, and we're kind of laying out the steps to what happiness looks like for them, right? It looks like success and achievement. And so not enough kids are being told like, wait, is even college the right choice for me? Is it the right choice right now? Or should I take a year off and find out what I want? Like, there's just not a ton of space in that in our society for kids to actually take that avenue without being seen as like an anomaly or a failure or weak somehow.
The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding their business and evolving their passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's hard for adults too. Like what, you have this like exchange in the book that I really like. It's two girls. Is it you? You're going back and forth, and you say, "What's your biggest hope?" Mm-hmm. And then Megan says, "To be able to go day to day and feel excited about it and feel full." And I wonder how many sort of adults like could actually not only describe their life that way, because I think most of them can't, but how many, if you ask them what their goal in life was, would be able to articulate that? So it's like, not only are we not working towards happiness, we don't even have an actual sense of what that happiness is. So oftentimes we're working towards the exact opposite of it, right? Like people get opportunities and they evaluate like, hey, is this paying me more money or not? You know, is this, and that's sort of almost the totality of how we judge opportunities in our lives, not does this get me closer to life, happiness, contentment, you know, fullness. And then we wonder why we have seemingly everything you're supposed to have and then are deeply unhappy and miserable.
Yeah, you make such a good point in that, it's, you know, it's easy when talking about this book to be like speaking about Maddie and kids who are in high school trying to make decisions. But part of the reason I was so interested in writing it was because I saw myself having the same confusion over what happiness and life look like. Because no matter how, even since writing this book, no matter how many times I remind myself that I know my version of happiness is, and probably a lot of people's, is not tied up in like having a cool job to tell people at the cocktail party and
sure,
having the paycheck and the relevance of the big job. Like I know that. I know that that's not happiness, but it's hard to deprogram from 30 plus years of believing that was the equation that would lead me to the happiness. And I find myself continually slipping into it, because really forming a life where you are constantly evaluating the decisions you make and whether they did lead to life satisfaction or wellness, like that's a challenging thing to constantly be doing. And it, the much easier thing is to just slip back into the equation that you had had learned for 30 years, right? So, and I find myself continually fighting that battle of not slipping back into like, well, maybe the big job will make me happy this time around.
Right.
Right. No, it's hard.
No, it's super hard. Like, yeah, I think this is a fantastic book. It's clearly had so much impact. It's changed so many people's lives. And like, I know that's true because one, it had that for me, but like, I get people emailing me, thanking me for having recommended it. So it's this weird thing where you do something that's really good and that's why you set out to do it. But then I imagine it's very tempting and distracting. Then you immediately go, yes, but how is it selling? And how is it selling compared to other people?
Oh yeah. I mean, and if you take this book in particular, because it's about a young woman who died by suicide, there's also it's separate than if you write a book that is not about, it's not about someone's death. It's not about such a tragic incident. It's hard enough to verbalize that like you want it to be financially successful or yeah. It's like everyone has to construct some reason for why they wrote their book. And it can't be because I want people to think I'm amazing and I want to make money, right? It has to be
sure. Some
sort of altruistic pursuit. And so, and writing this book was even trickier for me in how to talk about it because I didn't want to make it seem like I cared more about how I looked as a writer and what the impact of the book was in terms of my own success. Like measuring those things was really, really difficult given the topic, right? Because it's like, I don't want blood money. You know, I don't want to be getting rich off of someone else's story. So trying to balance all of that with also being honest about being a writer and caring that people thought it was good. I mean, you can't help but care about these things, even in the context of this, of a story about a young girl and working with her family. So all of that became very complicated for me when the book was being released, making sure I did everything that gave the right messaging for the book.
Was walking away from ESPN sort of difficult on the level that we're talking about? I imagine that's a thing you work your whole life to get. You know, there's a huge line of people behind you who think it's absolutely crazy that you would ever leave that party. How did you think about that?
There was a number of reasons why I left ESPN. And one of them was writing this book and feeling that within the book, I'm talking about some of Maddie's choices about caring more about what people thought than what she knew in her heart. And talking to so many student athletes, like the year the book came out, where that was also the message, was really looking at why you play your sport or what you're passionate about and getting in tune with those things. And perhaps there are different paths for athletes that they haven't thought that they could have taken because playing sports was just too cool to walk away from. So these are all the things I'm talking about where, and in my own life, I knew that my version of that was working at ESPN, was talking about sports and pretending to care about sports at a time in my life when I didn't care about them and didn't love them the way I used to, but I sure did like telling people that I worked at ESPN, and I sure did like cashing that check. So it was really trying to be honest with what I wanted, but in full transparency, I don't think I would have been strong enough to make the decision to leave ESPN if I also wasn't confronted with my dad's diagnosis of Lou Gehrig's disease. I thought it was interesting you brought up Lou Gehrig at the top of
this. Oh, wow, I didn't know.
And so that was kind of the last piece where I was like, am I going to be the person who continues moving forward in their life doing something that I know I don't fully love, but that gives me the kind of like, you know, the cachet that I want, and then sacrifice spending time with someone who I was so close with growing up? I couldn't justify all of those things. Once all of that happened, it didn't make leaving ESPN hard at all. It was so fully right when I did it that I haven't really had more than a moment here or there since then of wishing that I could go back and do that.
So what advice would you give someone? Because I've done that a couple of times in my career, where you sort of walk away from a thing that everyone thinks is obviously like the greatest thing in the world. And I've had trouble sort of articulating the logic behind it and how to go about it. But it's like, what do you wish maybe you'd heard from people as you were weighing that decision?
There was a couple of things. I mean, one of them, and again, this did relate to Maddie's story, because I know so many people in Maddie's life just wish that they knew that Maddie could have like taken a year off from school, right? That you can hit pause. Like, I know it sounds so obvious, but especially when you're in college and an athlete, but even in college at all, there's this sense of like, I'm in college and I'm like on this escalator moving upward. And like, you don't pause that. You just, you're on it. You did the work to get on it. And so of course you just keep riding it. And if I hit pause and I reevaluate my life, for me, that was like hitting pause on my career by leaving ESPN. There was nobody really, there was a couple people, which was great, but not enough being like, oh, if you get off the escalator and you hit pause, that doesn't mean you can't get back on the escalator. Like, I think we're too caught up in our society that like once you're in motion, you just got to stay in motion. And it was hard for me to really allow myself to absorb that lesson that like hitting pause and not being in motion anymore career-wise was about my own ego and my own identity crisis. And it wasn't real. Hitting pause wasn't going to keep me from ever moving forward again. In fact, I started to believe that as scary as it was, like I actually needed the time, not just with my dad, but I knew I was doing something at ESPN that I didn't love doing. And I was lucky enough to be able to say, well, am I just going to keep doing this thing, or am I going to hit pause and allow myself to actually sit in my own discomfort of not being able to tell people where I work and have this same identity? Am I going to be able to be uncomfortable and decide like who I want to be going forward?
No, I think that's a really good point. I think we it's almost as if we equate hitting pause with death. Like, so it feels almost like suicide, like career suicide, life suicide. Like when I dropped out of college, I remember I went into the registrar's office to drop out of college. I had this job as a research assistant. And I was like, you know, like I'm here to drop out of college. And they were like, you know, that's not a thing. They're like, you can't do that. You just fill out this form and you take like a semester off and then you re-enroll whenever you want. And it was striking to me how many kids are terrified of dropping out because they think it's an irrevocable decision. Just like they think that, you know, someone I know was, you know, thinking about leaving their job, and they went to leave their job and their boss was like, you know, we have like a sabbatical program here, right? Like you don't even actually need to quit your job. And so it's like these things are so intimidating and so few people do them. We almost don't have the understanding or the familiarity with them to actually understand that they're less scary than they look from the outside too.
Oh yeah. I think it seems terrifying. At least I imagine that's how Maddie felt in deciding whether or not to leave track and field, to stop playing a college sport, let alone to take a year off. I would assume that would seem to her like a decision that like would just irrevocably change her life. And similarly, even though my sample size was much larger and I was making my decision at 36, I had to continue to quell the part of me that felt like I was basically abandoning everything I'd ever worked for. But I don't think I ever knew who I was outside of all of these pursuits. And that was something I really wanted to find out.
Yeah. It's like for Maddie, a year off is 5% of her life.
Right.
You know, so it would seem so enormous. And then without the language about it, it really does seem crazy. And I think for you walking away from your job is something that I think we do a bad job thinking about too. It's like, you are not ESPN. We talked about your identity. It's like, your identity is not ESPN. Your identity is like the skills that you have and the point of view and the relationships you have that made ESPN want to hire you in the first place, which you're leaving with. So it's weird too that we think the risk is like leaving the job as if we don't continue to possess the most valuable assets, which is like who we are.
Yep. But a lot of our big companies, ESPN being one of them, I don't think they do this intentionally, obviously, but you very quickly understand that people are not going to care if I leave ESPN as much as I tell myself like that it matters, right? Like, it's very easy to start to believe when you're inside one of the bigger companies that you're just a cog in the machine. And if you leave, it is a piece of your identity that you're stripping away. And that's something I'm still working through. Like how to, I used to look forward to someone saying like, well, what do you do? Cause I could very easily impress them.
Sure.
And now if someone asks me that question, I'm kind of like, I don't want to be the person who says, well, I used to work at ESPN. Like,
right.
So it's still a daily battle. And like when you're inside one of those big machines, and maybe you can just look at our society as a big machine, you get easily reminded that you can be reminded that your skill set is a product of like the platform you're on in some way. And trying to unlearn that was part of the process for me too, that I have value that I offer, not just with the logo of ESPN by my name.
No, and I wonder how much of that explains where we are politically, right? I talked to David Frum and I was like, you know, I talked to all these different Republicans who are sort of very much not a fan of the president. And again, I don't think this has to be political. It's just an interesting paradox. They're not a fan of the president, but they won't say anything against him because they're worried that, you know, they might lose an election. And it's like, okay, well, what would happen to you if you lost the election? You'd go back to practicing the law, or you'd become a lobbyist, or, you know, you'd become a consultant, or maybe you'd run for a different office, right? And so it actually is really dangerous to have your identity tied up in what you do, because it deprives you of the freedom of making ethical or personal or professional decisions that you really need to be able to make. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, so what was coming up for me there was that, similarly, having nothing to do with Trump, but similarly, when I was at ESPN, because my identity became so tied up in, you know, being on ESPN and, you know, giving opinions on sports, and I didn't want to lose that, whether it was like the growing paycheck or the popularity, I lost sight of some of my own viewpoints about trying to speak about female athletes and women's sports. So the things I cared about that weren't as popular, that when I first got to ESPN, I would talk about them and push for them and care about them. The farther along I got, and the more I realized that if I just talk about LeBron and I just talk about men's sports, I'm going to be more popular and I'm going to make more money. And because that became my identity, I started to lose sight of things that growing up as a female athlete and wanting to be part of the solution and helping grow and give more opportunities to female athletes. I totally lost sight of that. And I abandoned it, not fully consciously, but there were moments where I was like, I know I've stopped doing what I care about in exchange for this growing part of my identity that was about money and relevance. And I could see how that's playing out so much in our political sphere too.
There's that Upton Sinclair quote, it's very hard to get someone to understand something when their salary depends on them not understanding it. It's like nobody wakes up and says, journalism is the same way. When you're measured based on what your traffic is, right, or how many shares your thing gets, it shouldn't surprise us that people gravitate towards one extreme or the other rather than sort of nuanced or difficult truth or what, you know, even what they actually care about.
And I mean, you can see that all across the sports world, and not just on the topics like Kaepernick or any of the topics where they're parallel to politics, but you could see it even in pitching stories on like a WNBA player. And in the beginning thinking, well, my identity is, when I first got to ESPN, my identity was in telling marginalized stories, however you see that, right? Like telling undertold stories. That was my identity because that's who I was. And that was the experience I had. And that was the expertise I brought. But very quickly, I didn't want to be someone who didn't get read, who people didn't tune into, And it became so much easier to talk about the mainstream story. And I think, you know, this is a separate media discussion when it comes to sports coverage and what the media covers, but it's very hard to get out of that cycle because it's like, how do you introduce new stories and characters in the sports world if everybody has the same 12 athletes they know, and those are the only stories that are getting clicked on? It's a very tough cycle to break out of.
Yeah. And it, I think it, you know, it takes courage either to leave or to stay and, you know, continue to march by your, you know, to the beat of your own drummer. There's that Henry Ford quote where it's like, if I listened to my customers, I'd have made a faster horse. You know, whether he said it or not, it's really problematic. It's like, if you got where you got because you have an original point of view, and then it can be very, you can be very easily seduced, and corrupted is a strong word, but just sort of directed, you know, towards what everyone is telling you they want. But over the long term, what people actually want is truth and originality. And so yeah, sometimes I think that's an important reason to, you know, live outside the system, maybe be somewhat employed outside the system. There's a reason that whistleblowers are often weirdos. Like I'm mm-hmm. watching Serpico right now, and it's like, he's a fucking weirdo. And that's why he didn't take bribes, not because he was just this profoundly ethical person, but by being a distinct, unique individual, he was able to see a corrupt system from a different point of view.
Yeah. And I think I knew, you know, not that I'm trying to compare myself to a whistleblower, but I think I knew that my time was up within the ESPN world to be heard or say anything different or new, because it wasn't within that world, people weren't reading things that I thought were interesting or different about different athletes and sports. Like they just weren't being read. And so then I could just be one of like 100 voices saying the same thing about the same 10 topics. And I felt like if I, in one small part, if I left, maybe my mind would be open up to see it from a different perspective. And maybe there's a way to actually tell the stories I wanted and get the ideas across. And it didn't have to be at ESPN, which to me would have been an unheard of thought for the first 5 years I worked there, you know, because it's like, sure, you want an idea conveyed, ESPN's the place. But I started to feel toward the end that it all started to sound the same, and it was hard to say something different within that noise.
No, I think that's beautifully said. I mean, life's too short to show up every day at a job you don't want to be doing. All right, so last question, because this has been really awesome. But have you read What Makes Sammy Run yet?
No, I haven't.
No, why not? So where did you get the title then? Did you know that the one was sort of an homage to the other, or was it totally independent?
Well, in full transparency, I fought very hard for a title for What Made Maddie Run. I wanted it to be called Filtered, because, and now I agree that What Made Maddie Run is a much more visceral title, but I wanted it to be called Filtered because I felt like it was, I don't know, more... It felt like this more philosophical title to me, and it was about social media and all the filters she put on her photos and the filters she put on herself. So I didn't even name the book.
Was your editor or your agent?
The publishing house, Little Brown, named it. I put up a fight, but now I do recognize that it was a good name for the book.
You have to read What Makes Sammy Run, because it's an amazing, it's one of my favorite books of all time. I rave about it here all the time. I'm trying to think. I just pulled it off the shelf. I was going to see if there's a good passage for you. I mean, to me, it's a great example. Like the What Makes Sammy Run is this sort of endless ambition that's not really about anything. It's just about getting ahead. And there's this beautiful quote in the book where he says, you know, it's sort of got this narrator who's observing it all, but he says something like, you know, what an impressive light, you know, ambition is when there's something behind it. And then he says sort of what a puny flickering flame it is when there isn't. And I mm-hmm. think, you know, we underrate that. And I'm just pulling it up. There's this great, this goes almost exactly to the quote we were talking about in the book, where he goes, it says, "Sammy," I said quietly, "how does it feel? How does it feel to have everything?" And like he ultimately gets everything. And then he realizes that it's totally meaningless and empty. And so mm-hmm. I think you would love the book. So that's my impassioned plea for you to read it.
I think you've mentioned that to me before in email. So I will make it my next read.
Good. Amazing. Well, thank you so much. I love the book. I think it's a parenting book. I also think it's just a book about life in the modern world. I think you've got some amazing, we didn't talk about it, but we have some amazing stuff in here about social media. I very much related to your lost days after you publish an article and you're just like refreshing to see what people thought of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The social media being a huge part of Maddie's story too. Yep.
Kate, thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Ryan.
If you're liking this podcast, we would love for you to subscribe. Please leave us a review on iTunes or any of your favorite podcast listening apps. It really helps. And tell a friend. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.